2009. Sometimes when I start off and I try to say the date, I completely glitch. I think, whoa, that's not a good sign. And this is a Patrick teleconference on spiritual and emotional health through restitution for real guilt. And it's Patrick Guide Lecture 109. And as I was reading through and prepping for this afternoon, naturally that's the time I read the part of the lecture that says, as I said in the lecture before, and I thought, oh dear, go back and pick up that lecture. So sometimes the guide references, he says, as I have said before, and that's very vague. There's not much you can do with that except do a lot of homework. But sometimes he's very specific, and he'll say, this is a continuation of the last lecture, and that happens a lot. So I'm going to pick up a little bit from the preceding lecture, because some of the ways, some of the things that were expressed in that one will help support an understanding of this lecture. So in a lecture that the shorthand version is restitution for real guilt, it's important to know what kind of guilt we're talking about. And the guilt that the guide is working to address in these two lectures is not as simple as having done something and not admitted it or made up for it and not wanting to be caught. It's a bit more subtle than that. So the primary guilt that the guide addresses in the previous lecture is the guilt for not wanting to love. And the guide indicates that that's really the source of all guilt. It's the source of all problems. So in the guilt for not loving, what he's saying is that all guilt comes from our lower self. So you may not have done anything that you are actively aware of that you feel guilty about, but guilt shows up in many ways, part of what this lecture is about. So guilt, I looked it up in the dictionary. Seemed like a good place to start. And it says being responsible for the commission of an offense. And yet in the lecture, it uses a phrase that means a lot to me because it's also used in Jewish prayers, especially on Yom Kippur. And it talks about that there's a guilt around commission and omission. Okay? So you can do something active that isn't right, or is basically it's part of your lower self acting out. But that there is also a guilt that we carry for things we have not done. And that is more subtle. That's harder to get your hands on. So a lot of the guilt that this lecture talks about, when the guide talks about the sin, to some extent, of not loving. Well, the loving would be active. But not loving, how do you find that? How do you see it? How do you touch it? How do you address it? So one aspect of this is that if you're aligned with your lower self, wherever you're aligned with your lower self or acting out on the basis of your lower self, you're going to have problems in your life. So you can kind of toss all the areas that are going swimmingly because those are probably not areas that you're aligned with your lower self, or if you are, it's not to the surface yet. So it's hard. You're not going to get a lot back out of looking at the happy times and the good times, the things that seem to roll smoothly. And that's another thing that the guide talks about in these lectures, is that one of the manifestations of the sin of not loving is trying to hold back the life force. But the guide saying that the natural state of being is to let the life force move through you, to be in the flow of life. He uses water terms a lot. He uses at one point he talks about floating. That there's a place of floating with the energy of the universe that allows you to move spontaneously, depending on what the circumstances are. And that when we contract and basically say, I won't, or I'm afraid, or I'm not good enough. In that contraction, we're not allowing the flow of energy to move through us. We're creating a dam, a stagnation of energy based on the fact that we're afraid, that we're invested, that if we let the flow of life move, you're going to find something out about me. Society will find out that I'm not good if I allow myself to be who I am. Now, a few nights ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to attend Leonard Cohen's concert here in Austin. And I think I'm very fortunate because the tickets were very, very hard to get. And at that concert, when you observe the gentleman, he's older. He makes a joke at one point about when he was a kid of 60 with a crazy dream, because that's the last time he did concerts. I think he's 75 now. And he's an unusual man, and he's odd, and his stage presence is unusual. And what I got out of watching him was, for one thing, everybody in the audience adored him. I don't think I've heard applause like that and cheering like that for a performer. And the second thing I noticed was that nobody cared that he was odd. I don't want to go into the mannerisms, but he's an unusual person. And nobody cared. They just wanted to hear him. They just wanted to experience the gentleman's talent and the energy that he put out. And what I took away from that was a sense of my own self where I'm a little bit afraid to put myself out and to be natural because maybe it'll look funny or odd or I make too much... I'm sure you can fill in the blanks with aspects of yourself that you tend to hold back or prune. This is what the guide is talking about. Now, he's not saying that this is the worst thing in the world. He's simply saying that in doing this, we're restricting our life flow, and on some level of our being, this is not love. This is not being loving. Besides the fact that you're not willing to be out there and meet another human being the way you are, there's a place where you have judged who you are and where you're only going to allow out what you think will be accepted, which to some extent shortchanges the other person. So when I say it's not a loving thing to do to withhold yourself, it's not loving to you. It doesn't show a self-acceptance of yourself. It also does not allow another person to witness your real self. So when we only put out what looks good, you wind up with a world full of only actions that look good, and it encourages people who have doubts about themselves not to put themselves out. Because, well, I'm not that good. So in a slightly circular way, any unlovingness that you feel about yourself, any place where you hold yourself back from loving, you are also setting a stage for someone else to do the same thing. To some extent, you are inviting them to collude that only the best should be put forward. So there's a little circle that's described in the lecture about this, very tiny vicious circle. And it's about, the guide uses the phrase impaired integrity. So first he talks about loving energy and being loving and approving of yourself and putting yourself out. Then he switches to a place where he talks about impaired integrity. The place where you are not in full integrity with yourself. Now notice that there's no objective reality to this. There's no standard to put up against you. There's no ruler to say, oh, you're 3 inches short of full integrity. The integrity the guide is talking about is your integrity. However you think things should be like, there are places where your integrity has dents in it. There's places where your integrity doesn't act itself out fully because it would keep you from gaining something that you wanted. And in exercising impaired integrity in the world, we realize what we're doing. We have a knowing. There's a deep knowing in us of what we're doing. And so to compensate for that, we try to seek acceptance from others. So the guide first talks about the flow of energy and loving people and letting yourself out of love for yourself and love for your fellow man and wanting everybody to put themselves out. So there's a real circular pattern of love going on there. And in the second pattern, what he's talking about is you have an impaired integrity and you know about it. So what you're trying to do is get acceptance from somebody else to make up for the fact that you're not accepting of yourself. So any forcing current you have to gain acceptance from others may come from a place where you do not accept yourself. And I almost have this feeling that if you could just peek under that, if you could just lift that little piece of flagstone as to why you can't accept yourself, that's where you're going to find a piece of impaired integrity. Some place where you are not willing to be everything you can be in this moment. And that's a third place the guide talks about, that just because we're not at a certain level of development, we judge ourselves. So there's a place where we may be able to see where we want to go. And the mere fact that we are not there yet, instead of accepting the positive of that, which is I know where I'm going, I have a real clear picture of who I want to be and how I want to interact with the world and how I want to manifest my values and help. I really have a vision. That's a tremendously positive statement. But instead of staying with that positive, we have turned around and judged ourselves for not being there. Now, there's a joke buried in there, and that is that if you can't see it, you can't attain it. So the very thing that gives us the ability to grow and develop, we use against ourselves by saying, yeah, and you're not there yet. If you really knew what honesty was, you'd be honest, and you're not. And that's what we do to ourselves. And one of the places where lower self integrates into our lives is it's as if it whispers in our ear, you're not there yet. Yeah, we see it, but you're not good enough. You tried yesterday, but you didn't measure up. And it is actually the positive part of us that cringes and reacts to the fact that we're not there. So lower self tends to use the child part of us, the part of us that's not mature and is not fully confident that we can achieve our goals, to prevent us from ever achieving those goals because now we're in contraction and shame, and from that place you're not going to get to those goals. So what this lecture addresses is an attempt to become more mature. This is a place where you need your ego. Ego was, did a teleconference a while back on ego, and people would say, why do you need one? Because ego gives us a sense of proportion. Ego, like the objective observer, stands back and says, now, wait a minute, it's not all bad. I know we have a few glitches here, but we can work these out. Okay? That's what the ego does. It's a traffic cop. It manages things. It says, yes, we're going to get there. We're going to need to go get some more information. We're going to need to do some more research. We may need to take a class. We may need to go call a friend. Okay, so yes, we see what we're going to do, and we're going to need more support to get there, so we're going to marshal that support. That's the level of maturity that the guide is addressing here. So it's not about what you've done. It's not about your imperfections, especially your imagined ones, but even your real ones. This lecture is about dealing with the mere fact that as a human being, you're not perfect, and you probably aren't going to be perfect. So what do you do in that situation? So I'm going to switch for a second and talk about how we make the guilt worse. So what I've been speaking of is the fundamental reason why we feel guilty, and that is that we try to stagnate or withdraw our life force, and that we're not accepting of ourselves and loving of ourselves, and we judge ourselves and we tumble into shame and blame, even if it's subtle, inside up. Now, if you're blaming yourself, you're going to be perfectly able to blame somebody else and judge and not accept someone else. So it's all one. So in terms of manifesting this, okay, once you've got an idea of the fundamental sense of guilt that's going on, which is a spiritual one, and the guide at one point talks in the lecture about psychology, and it's funny because I would choke before saying this, and the guide sometimes speaks very strongly, you know, finger wagging, psychology doesn't do this, and I almost gasp, like, well, that'll get some reactions from people. But that's me, because I'm human, and the guide doesn't seem to be unwilling to put things out sometimes. And so he talks about the fact that psychology hasn't quite got it yet, because they're dealing with the effects. They're dealing with mental illness and neurosis. And the place the guide is coming from is the cause of mental illness, the cause of neurosis, the cause of forcing currents. And in this lecture, what he says is the cause is fundamentally not being willing to love. So once the cause is going, then we can talk about effects, remembering that that's all they are, is effects. So in the initial sentence of this lecture, Guy talks about man would rather produce much worse guilt that are untrue than accept the tiniest real guilt belonging to the area of the lower self that he is unwilling to accept. So there are a lot of terms, and I find them very handy. The guide doesn't use them, but I'm going to bring them in. And by focusing on false guilt, some of the mechanisms for focusing on false guilt, one includes exaggeration. And exaggeration is talked about in the lecture on reason, will, and emotion. Because an emotion type will over-dramatize and over-exaggerate a situation because they want the juice, they want the emotion, they want the sense of connection, and if they can't have it or they feel that it's being withdrawn from them or withheld from them, they will ramp things up so that, in effect, emotion floods over into a situation and there is a stronger feeling of connection. You can also use exaggeration as a distraction. So what the guide is describing is that if I have a fundamental guilt for not loving and therefore aligning with my lower self, one of the ways I can relieve this sense of guilt is to find something else to focus on, to exaggerate some other aspect of my character or personality or something else I have done that is not as serious as this fundamental not wanting to love. But society will play it with those games. So, bad phrasing. That's a sandbox that society likes to play in. So it's a place where everybody gets together, and they might be willing to talk and to pick on each other about some things that really aren't so serious. Well, if you're talking about things that aren't very serious, you're not talking about a fundamental guilt for not loving. It's a way of distracting from what really bothers you and filling your life with energy in another area. So psychology uses various terms. One is displacement for this kind of avoidance. So displaced guilt is like the old vaudeville joke that I tell a lot, where somebody's looking for something and the friend comes over and says, "What are you doing? I lost something." And they say, "Where?" And they say, "Over there." "Why aren't you looking over there?" "Because the light's better." Displacement allows you to feel like you're doing something, whether or not you are, when you may be stuck or unwilling to work in the place that actually contains the problem. So displacement, exaggeration, distraction are ways where we would rather deal with false guilt than real guilt. And for two reasons. One is that we may not know how to address the real guilt. But of course, if you don't do it, you'll never learn. So it's a vicious circle in itself. To avoid something, you manage not to learn about it. And the second is that we do have life force. You can never contain life force. So since it can't go where the blockage or stagnation is, we give life force someplace else to go, even if it's not productive, and even if it is counter to the values that we say we hold. And of course, what happens there is that you increase the nagging sense of guilt within you. Now, there are two other ways of distracting yourself that get more and more serious. One of them is a term that I'm very fond of. So when you're fond of something, you use it more than perhaps you should. So here I go. I love the concept and the phrase cognitive dissonance. And what that tries to describe is a place where you're given two realities and they just don't fit. The two realities sound like they must be or, they can't be and they seem to exclude each other. And you can't figure out how these two fit together. Square peg in round hole. So you either throw the round peg away and live with the square hole, or ignore the square hole and live with the round peg. Cognitive dissonance is a way where we cannot deal with the discrepancy between two ideas or two feelings or two situations. And so we choose what to believe. The second is a kind of denial that can start off actively and then become passive. And by that, what I'm trying to describe is there is a place where we know that if we put something away, we will forget about it. So if we bury the evidence, perhaps no one will ever dig it up. Now, in the act of bearing the evidence, is that bad? Well, there's all kinds of denial. There's all kinds of justification. We can be reacting to fear. We can be afraid that this thing would keep us from having something that we feel we need. We can feel pride. We can feel like we would be rejected if somebody knew about this. It can be an act of self-will. The guide mentions that all these things have to do with pride, fear, and or self-will. So when we hide this, we are in distortion. But all you have to do is do a good job of hiding it in the moment. So one moment of weakness and you tuck it away, or hide the evidence, or burn the paper. And if it never surfaces again, if you've done a grand job of hiding, in theory, you got away with it. But not according to the lectures, not according to the guide, and not according to spiritual law. What you have done is you have disconnected cause and effect. And yet, on a soul level, on a real self level, you will always know what you've done. The dilemma becomes that your conscious mind may actually forget the circumstances. So, being a movie fan, one of the movies that I like very much for teaching this is the movie Memento, because it hinges on the fact that the character knows that they have a short-term memory problem. The character knows that if they do something now, in 6 to 10 minutes, they will no longer remember it because of a biological brain injury, the inability to retain short-term memory. And so at one point in the film, he deliberately writes down a lie, knowing that in 10 minutes, he will presume that he wrote down the truth. And he will never, on a conscious level, be able to unwrap, to undo what he's done. And while that may be true on a human level, we are talking about responsibility on a soul level. So you don't get away with it. However, the lesson that you're learning may continue into the next life. There's a longer arc here than our human lives. So this is a cute movie moment, but what I'm referring to here is a place where in this life you may successfully hide something so well you never find it again in this life. So active denial that that's a problem winds up becoming passive because you don't have to do anything else about it. And what that means is that you may have to go back into an active state of wanting to find it, to find it. So when people say, I'm upset but I don't know the reason, that may be true. On a conscious, cognitive level, they may be telling the truth. It doesn't change the fact that there is something there. So all these lectures are about supporting us in actively going after the places where we turned away from God, where we turned away from our fellow man, where we aligned with our lower self and tried to get away with it, and where our self-will is demanding that we be able to do what we want, instead of being willing to open our arms and embrace what might be best for all of us. That's what's in every single lecture. So what I was talking about is there's different ways for this to happen, depending on degree. You've got displacement. You've got focusing on false guilt so that you can avoid the real guilt. Cognitive dissonance, where you just can't figure it out, so you choose. Okay? You've got exaggeration, dramatizing something so much that you're enthused by that and you just tend to ignore the small problem that is actually the real problem. Distraction, denial. And then there are even more subtle ones. There is numbness. There is confusion. So when someone says, I'm confused, I can't figure it out, that may be true, but the work is about saying, okay, you're confused. And you may be confused because you're a little scared. And learning to hold yourself with the help of other people, learning to hold yourself with love, like you'd hold a small child and say, it's going to be okay, but we need to calm down, we need to relax, we need to focus. So let's just breathe. And let's be objective. We'll use objective tools. List off what's going on. Try to figure out what the op is. These are the things that mature adults do when they're in trouble and confused and upset. So confusion alone is simply a momentary situation. It's not an answer to a problem. And it's not going to resolve anything. And sometimes that is its intent. To not resolve. I'm confused, I can't deal with it. And numbness goes even further. Deal with what? So in numbness, we lose connection to what's bothering us. But that, again, is only on the cognitive personality level. You can't keep up numbness forever. Eventually, you're going to come back into feeling, and there's going to be something gnawing at you. So I spent this time talking about guilt, about how we try to dodge guilt. You know, I can't hurt, maybe you can get away with it. Can't hurt to try. Then the guide talks about that there are two steps to dealing with false guilt, real guilt, and restitution. The one is finding and facing. And that's why it's important to know real guilt from false guilt and to know these tricks and techniques. There's even a lecture, I don't remember the number right now, on ego tricks. Okay? But to find and face things can take huge amounts of time. There's a quote in the lecture at some point, I think in the questions and answers, where the guide says, yes, this takes an enormous amount of time. Okay? But if you don't start, you won't get there. So the fact that it takes an enormous amount of time doesn't change the fact that that's the process. So the first step is always finding and facing what is actually going on. And the second step of restitution, the guide also breaks into two parts. He talks about the first step being to share with another person. And I don't think he spells it out quite this way, but you don't have to do everything at once. It's not all or nothing. Oh, I finally realized what I've done, and now I'm just going to open the floodgates and shout it from the rooftops. No. That's not what you have to do. And it can be destructive. You can move too fast, and you're not prepared to move ahead. So the guide is suggesting that we move in stages, one step at a time. And if you're not ready, the least you can do is simply be present with your unreadiness. And circling back around, that's a loving thing to do. An inability to accept that you have finally found a truth that you are very uncomfortable with, and that you're not quite willing or able in this moment to move on it. In a loving acceptance, we can hold ourselves. And if any of you have had occasion to support someone who has felt they really screwed up. Doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have to be massively legal. It doesn't have to be massively moral. It can be the smallest thing. Saying something stupid or insulting. Letting something come out of your mouth that you regret terribly. Can feel like the fires of hell. And if any of you have ever held someone, you know what this is about. Because what they need to hear is it's not the end of the world. It's not. It can be if you continue down a path of refusing to deal with it, that there could be some end of the world here, or an end of a job, or an end of a friendship. But in this moment, lovingly holding someone and reminding them of the good qualities that they have and saying, yes, this is something that you do. You blurt out things, and it reveals a bias. We're not even going to excuse the nastiness of what you might have said. But we can still love you. I can still love you. I can help you hold a sense of proportion about this incident. And part of that sense of proportion is figuring out if anything should or can be done at the moment, or whether we need to reflect and think about it. That the act of a friend, whether it was you doing it for someone or having that done for you by a friend, is one of the most loving moments I have ever experienced. To not be condemned by another human being in a place that is admirable in myself. So the first step in restitution, the guide suggests that you just share with another person what went on. And then the guide says you need to do something. You need to make good. You need to atone. Now, it doesn't go on into detail there, and that's why I included in the study materials that are on the internet a copy of the 12 steps. Now, a teacher, a pathwork helper named Barbara Gladman-Cohen, her last name is now Azara, prepared these for a workshop that she did. And she rewrote the 12 steps so that they reflected the teachings that she does based on Emmanuel's statement that fear is the only addiction on the planet. So she rewrote the 12 steps a little bit, so I thought that that would be more fitting than the standard 12 steps put in the study material. And what I notice when I go through this is that there are 12 steps, and on step 5, an entire step is to admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, when you say God, ourselves, and another human being, this is a sequence. This is not an instantaneous thing. So even step 5 is broken down into 3 parts. To God, to ourselves, and another human being. Then you go through a few more steps to kind of work on yourself until step 8. That's 3 steps later. On step 8, it's make a list of all persons we have harmed and be willing to make amends. Just be willing. Make the list, make it concrete, and be willing to make amends. And if you've ever been through the 12-step program, sometimes a step will take 3 months and sometimes 3 days. Depends. Step 9 is to make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So it's a suggestion to go one step further, a suggestion to make your contrition, your sense that you've done something wrong, even more tangible by taking a step towards the people you have harmed. But even then, the caution is to not blow through this, but to notice if this is the appropriate thing to do in the moment. And then step 9, so you know we've got 3 steps involved with getting out there and getting active. Sorry, step 8 was to make a list of all persons we harmed. Step 9 was to make direct amends. And step 10 is to continue to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, to promptly admit it. In other words, in the 10th step, what you're saying is this is not a one-time deal. We continue to cycle around and to notice what we do and to do something about it. And then we notice what we do and do something about it. And we keep the life force flowing. We're not done. This is what happens. Breathing is never done. Eating is never done. There are a lot of things in life that you just don't do once. And for most of us, one of them is learning how to apologize, to reflect upon our actions, and to take action, to take responsibility, and do something about it. So I included that because even though the guide breaks restitution down into 2 parts, I just noticed that the 12 steps broke it down into 3 or 4, depending on how you count, 3, 4, or 5 parts. This is a big deal. Actually making restitution could be a significant life event. Because the truth is, if you wreck somebody's car, you can give them another car, you can repair their car, you can do a lot of things, but you cannot put them back to the moment before you did it. You cannot take away their sense of fragility. You can't take away the fact that they thought they were safe and suddenly they found they were not. That can't be brought back. So making restitution is a creative process.